one Christmas morning when he had been working Christmas Eve, and he came home and some steel had exploded and some red hot steel had run the whole way down his back, and he was in horrible pain. That was Christmas morning. And I know he just hated the last years at the mill, and he did it. He was just counting the days till he retired. So they were always encouraging me to go on and do things. And then
did they stay in Butler for the rest of their...
Yeah. They both died when they were in their 70s, early 70s.
Right. So then, once having set your sights on Rochester, were there any bumps along the way to getting there, or what was that like? Applying, did you think of any of those?
I'm flabbergasted when I look back on that now, and that I said, this is what I want to do. I need there's a one special class of scholarships at Rochester. I'll apply to Rochester for that scholarship, and I'll get it. I didn't apply to anybody else, any place else, or do anything else, except this is what I was going to do. And I did. I got the fellowship and the scholarship, and went and enrolled in the optics program.
What was it that caught your attention about the optics program, or could you tell me about it?
I don't know. It just seemed a little more exciting than pure science, I didn't understand it very well, you know, what I was getting into, but it was a marvelous program. I'm glad I did it.
Mm. Well, had you visited Rochester before?
No.
So what was your impression of the school and the town?
Well, to me, Rochester was a town 10 times as big as Butler, so it was a big city.
Right.
Yeah. And I liked it. The due to George Eastman's prejudices, the men's and women's campus were separated by 5 miles. So it wasn't a very exciting social life without a car or any money. So I had this fellowship, and I waited on tables and graded math papers and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And the optics program was extremely rigorous, and optics experiments were very time-consuming. So I just was working steadily for all those years.
Now, was this were the faculty in the optics program, had they been doing war work, or
yes,
yeah,
mm-hmm. And they come out with some pretty interesting anecdotes about the sort of things they did.
Mm-hmm.
There was an awful lot of key optical work. Rochester was the only optics program of any size in the country.
Oh, I hadn't realized that.
And with its association with Eastman Kodak and Bausch and Lomb.
Okay, sure.
And it supported the program. The program was started about 1930.
Hmm.
And the professors were, there were probably a dozen of the faculty, and also they had access to the key people at Kodak. Rudolph Kingslake, who was just he died last year at age 104, was one of the key optical designers, probably the best the world has ever seen. While working at Kodak, he taught our optical design course.
Wow.
And, they had as I said, the program was rigorous, and 20 of us started in optics that year, and half dropped out every year, and ended up with 5 of us graduating. And I optical phenomena is still fascinating to me, and getting in there and being able to measure something to the fraction of a wavelength of light, participating in all these things, was just I liked it a lot.
And they really engaged the undergraduates in research over the course of those 4 years.
Well, I could see what was going. I didn't, of course, wasn't doing any.
Right.
But I could see what was going on. It was a small, very stimulated environment.
Mm-hmm. And were the four other sort of survivors, did they go to work for some of the local optical firms like Kodak and Bausch?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. Certainly not Bausch and Lomb.
Right.
But optics was so much in demand after mm-hmm. the war that there were a lot of other opportunities.
Right.
And I had, again, a very interesting industrial experience before I got out of school, and that this was just when the Korean War was starting.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great shortage of optical people. So Kodak said they would hire in the summer between our junior and senior year one person from our class to go to work there for the summer, which would pick me.
Mm-hmm.
And they said go to work in our film processing plant. And I've always, when I didn't like something, would go try to rectify it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just called them up and said, look, it doesn't matter to you, I don't think, a whole lot, but it would matter a whole lot to me if you would assign me to your Hawkeye plant where they're working on optical instrumentation rather than working in the film plant.
Right.
And they said, oh, why not? And so, oh, by the way, the salary scale is higher in the optical plant. So I just looked at for what I wanted and managed to get it. And I had a fascinating time there.
What were they working on there?
I was put in a division that was sort of a troubleshooting for the whole company. So I was just all over that plant. I spent most of this summer working on the B-52 was just being developed then. It's amazing we're still using the thing 50 years later. But I was working on a huge camera that they were using for optical, for ground photography from the B-52. I mean, the lens weighed about a couple hundred pounds. You had to lift it with a crane.
Oh my gosh, so huge.
And so I got involved in some of the testing on that. And one thing in particular, this thing was going to stick out of that airplane, so they had to know how it would behave at 60 below zero. And so I spent a fair amount of time at 60 below zero with a big fur suit on testing this lens.
What did you, but in just a refrigerated room?
In a refrigerated room with somebody outside watching me make sure I didn't keel over or something. But it was fascinating work. And again, I was working with PhDs, which is the same thing I had done when I was at Butler, and could interact on that level with people. And
what did you do with your other summers?
I worked
back
with Preston. So I was always spending all my summers working with skilled researchers.
Do you think that experience working in Preston's laboratory on the glass work also oriented you toward optics?
No, I don't think
no,
so.
No connection.
I don't think there's anything except it was just glass. I don't know why it made me so intrigued with optics. It seemed to have happened. And my father would always like the role of being a mentor to young people and helping them help make career decisions. And he did that his whole life.
Hmm.
He was always interested in that. And he obviously was interested in me.
Yeah.
So.
And while the course of study was very rigorous, what sort of extracurricular activities did you make time?
Not a whole lot. Yeah. I worked for a little while on the campus radio station and things like that, but I was working 7 days a week, very long hours.
Right.
These lab courses would take, you know, someone would take a 5-hour afternoon, and then plus maybe another 5 hours to write up the results.
Mm.
That was working.
Just because of the precision set up for the optical experiment.
Yes, yeah. They're difficult experiments.
Yeah.
Now, these were not trivial experiments. They were very serious optics.
Mm-hmm. And your group of peers and friends, were those from the optics program or from the dormitories?
No, it was just dormitories.
Yeah.
We weren't in fraternities, so we had a group of our close friends.
Right.
That I maintained relationship with. We had our Rochester's anniversary, and the group of maybe six of us who were close then all got together for a dinner in which we recounted our life, what it had been since Rochester.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting thing. So we stayed. I stayed close to those people. It was a relatively small group, but it was
mm-hmm.
very closely knit group.
And what sorts of things did that peer group go on to do after Rochester?
They all got doctorates.
Hmm. In the sciences, or mm-hmm. all of them?
Hmm. Well, one was an MD, one was
right.
Hendricks, that was physical chemistry. Greenler went on to do great work in optics. And
okay.
Head of the Optical Society, for example.
Oh.
Bob Greenler. Kay Huntington got a MD. Bob Anderson got a MD.
Do you think you were drawn together by your technical interests, your scientific and technical interests?
Not so much.
It just
happened to be assigned a roommate or something. And
right.
Make a lifelong friendship from that.
And as, I did read something that Bob Hendricks wrote, speaking of you, saying of all the people I knew in college, Jay would have seemed one of the least likely to become an entrepreneur at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering why you thought he might have had that impression.
Well, I was pretty dedicated toward setting up my life for a research career.
Right.
And I didn't have the sort of outgoing thing that you would associate with somebody who's going to end up running the business.
Right. And what about reading? Did you continue to read at such a pace?
I read whatever I could read, but
yeah.
Not that much. I was
in the lab.
Just working.
Yeah.
This was a very time-consuming program, as I said.
Yes.
But I felt that I was going to go on in physics, or physics was going to play a major role, so I took at least a good course in electricity and magnetism, and
mm-hmm.
pretty tough physics courses.
As well.
Yeah. As well as the optics. So I was had some preparation for graduate school in physics, although I missed a couple of key courses.
Mm. You had made that decision to attend graduate school and to attend MIT early on. Was it a similar experience with going to Rochester, making a move to MIT? Just
no. I had a great mentor on the Rochester faculty, Parker Gibbons. And I wrote him a while back and thanked him for all of this, but he was more aimed toward physical optics rather than geometrical optics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking him how I should, what what I should be doing in the future. And he said, well, if you stay here at Rochester, you're and get a doctor in optics, you'll get about the quickest and easiest doctor than anybody got, because you've already taken all the courses here.
Right.
And so you might have the satisfaction of having some of the people with your lab instructors have be there. So, but he said, I would strongly advise you to think of getting a doctorate in solid state physics, which encompasses optical phenomenon, and it's just a growing, just starting field.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't even a textbook on solid state physics then, just scattered
right
things. And he really persuaded me that was the thing to do.
Wow.
And I applied to MIT and to Cornell and to Michigan.
Mm-hmm. And
which were the three schools that he could recommend that we're starting work in solid state physics. And so I was accepted by all of them, and I needed to get some financing, so I was
sure
looking for a fellowship scholarship, and I could see those would come pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the choice to make. Michigan looked a little too big, and they said if your name starts with A through L, A through C, you show up this day to register.
Okay.
And I thought, that doesn't appeal to me. And I would discuss this with my boss at Kodak, who had a doctorate from Harvard. And I said, I had these choices. He said, Jay, there's no decision you have to make. He said, everybody owes it to themselves to spend 5 years of their life in Cambridge. And I said, well, that's as good a reason as any other. So I just called up MIT that day and accepted.
Yeah. And was Parker Parker Gibbons, was he a younger man at this time, or was he?
He was then. He was probably.
Yeah.
He's still around, and he must be in his 80s now, so he was probably in his 30s then.
Right. I was just wondering why he was, well, it's interesting to think about why he would be attuned to...
Well, he had done his physical optics and solid-state physics, of course, are
sure
very close, and they're tied in. The solid-state physics is most of the investigation of it then was by optical means.
Right.
A lot of it. And so he had gotten into that side of it, and he could see how this was developing. And especially right after the war, I mean, there was so much basic research done in the war.
Mm-hmm.
that was just now starting to come out and hadn't been exploited.
Right.
And that's what made this enormous push in the 10 years after the war, was just being able to use this whole bucket of technology that had not been developed. And it hadn't been developed in the Depression either. So we were really looking at 20 years of investigation of new physical phenomena that had not been turned into products yet.
Right.
And they were just all sitting there waiting. And so that would have an enormous explosion after, right after the war.
Mm. And and so then you began MIT in 1951, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And so did you find your boss to be correct that you did owe it to yourself to spend
time
in Cambridge? Yeah.
Now I was in a big city, in a very interesting big city, and so I like Boston a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting to be an outside observer looking at Boston, because it's a pretty screwy political system. It certainly was then.
Mm.
Mayor Curley was elected from a because that time was in the federal penitentiary and was, was reelected. And so I said, you know, and seeing the strong tribalism of the
mm-hmm.
Irish and the Italians, it was just fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I enjoyed that a lot.
And did you live in Cambridge?
I lived in the graduate house
mm-hmm.
at Cambridge. My
and what
5 years there.
So what was the general atmosphere like at MIT in the physics department or the many physics laboratories, I guess, that must have been in existence at that time?
Yeah, well, they were just getting over the war. A number
sure.
of these guys had been at Los Alamos. Some of them had sort of been out of shape because they sort of realized how their scientific work, which they thoroughly enjoyed doing, had been used.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of number of people were not in terribly good shape, I don't
mm-hmm.
think. But there was this big time of transition.
And what was the radiation laboratory? I mean, certainly the building was still there, but were some of those wartime laboratories still in existence?
They took all the radiation laboratory stuff and moved it out to Lexington.
Right.
And so that stuff was gone and was all classified work,
mm-hmm.
which there was an awful lot of soul searching at MIT, I believe, at the time. Should an educational institution be involved in this degree of classification?
Mm.
Could you give a classified doctor's degree, for example?
Right.
These were serious questions, but that was beyond. But the old Building 20, where all this took place, was demolished 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
They sent me a piece of it.
Great.
So, but. And so I, von Hippel.
Yeah.
Who, again, it's amazing, all these people that were close to me died in the last year or so. Von Hippel died at 104. But he had done a lot of the work necessary for the high voltage breakdown insulating material was necessary for radar.
Okay.
And during mm-hmm. the war, he developed all that stuff, and which made him a fair-haired boy with the Bureau of Naval Research or whatever.
Oh yeah, officer.
ONR. ONR.
Right, yeah.
ONR. So ONR supported his laboratory work.
Mm-hmm. And what was the process like for you and for others at that time of sorting out who it was you were really going to work with? Was that something that you did early or after you had done some coursework?
You mean, in von Hippel's laboratory?
Yes.
This fellow who later on ended up working with me was Alton Gellio, who had one of the laboratories in von Hippel's group, and they needed a research assistant to work there. And he saw my name on the resumes and said, "With his optics background, this is what we need here.
Mm.
We're working in spectroscopy and things." So they offered me that, and it looked fine to me. And so I worked there. And von Hippel's laboratory was—I probably learned as much there as I did in the organized curricula, because this was a laboratory that had metallurgists and physical chemists
mm-hmm.
and X-ray people, just the whole spectrum people.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know them all, what they were doing, and we were all working on the same general area of the thing dealing with the electrical properties of materials.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a weekly seminar. Von Hippel was of the old German school, but so he tried to keep you there working forever. The physics department said, "Well, we're not going to give you any more physics candidates if you don't get him out of here in 5 years. But he'd been happy to have it be a 7 or 8 year, 9 year program.
Right. And was he carefully orchestrating a research program then that he was fitting people into, or?
He was very interested in the perovskite structures, ferroelectric materials,
right.
And barium titanate, which I ended up doing my doctoral thesis on.
Mm-hmm.
There were a number of people working on various titanates. You could see the very interesting properties that these materials had, and the extraordinary potential for practical use of some of the ferroelectric materials.
What were the applications for? Well, what were the envisioned applications for these materials, and then what came to be?
The memory would be the key.
Oh.
Computer memories, which now looks trivial, but at that time that was the big drawback between computers. So you just couldn't. Memory was frightfully expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And there were programs on magnetic equivalents of this also, but an awful lot of it was aimed toward computer memories.
How about that? Mm-hmm.
So, and von Hippel hired a fellow he had known in Germany. Germany before the war, you know, with Niels Bohr's laboratory, these guys all knew each other.
Right.
And this fellow was head of developed research and work at Zeiss during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to be able to talk to him. He and I were pretty close, Alexander Smakula. And after, so I got to know him, and stories like this was in the Eastern Zone, and the Russians were coming. They were trying to move all these top technical people to the West, and he had something like 3 hours to pack and get out of there. And he said, I had made the hard choice between leaving all my technical notes or my children's toys, and I took my children's toys.
Wow. Because that did, then Zeiss was in the,
yeah,
in the East, mm-hmm, wasn't it, thereafter?
And he told me fascinating stories, like he had developed the idea of optical coating. You put coating on lenses,
sure,
and a reflection. And he packed up a whole unit of this stuff that was put on a submarine taken to Japan, which got the Japanese started in the optical coating business.
Oh my gosh.
He had more fascinating stories of things like that.
And so you had a research assistantship essentially in,
yeah,
the laboratory,
mm-hmm,
then? And
the laboratory was nominally under the head of the electrical engineering department.
Okay.
But it was, as I said, it was so interdisciplinary, you couldn't tell what department it was in.
And that was really from von Hippel, wasn't it? That interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary,
yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm, approach.
Yeah, he had. He wasn't a extraordinarily deep scientist, but he was very broad.
Mm-hmm.
And he could see the enormous advantage of interaction between people of different disciplines, which is now the common idea. They're trying to do this,
yeah,
30 or 40 years later, but he did it.
And would you say that the majority of your time was spent in this research assistantship capacity, or how much time was spent in seminars or coursework?
Well, I was,
yeah,
I don't know how it was divided up. I would guess I was spent 10 hours a week or so in the research end of things. And later on, that was my thesis, so there was no, I was essentially getting paid full time to work on my thesis.
Right.
But I went through MIT without some key physics courses. And after I was there, you know, 6 months or a year, I had to pass a qualifying exam, and I had to know, for example, thermodynamics and nuclear physics, which I just had to teach myself.
What was that like?
Oh, that was terrible. I have no fondness for either of those subjects to this day. But I did it.
Right.
Let's see.